Welcome to Talaterra, a podcast about freelance educators working in natural resource fields and environmental education. Who are these educators? What do they do? Join me, and let's find out together. This is your host, Tanya Marion. My guest today is Anne Armstrong. Anne is an author, an educator, and a PhD student in the Department of Natural Resources at Cornell University. Anne is also the mother of a 3-year-old daughter who inspires her work investigating how environmental educators communicate about climate change. Anne stopped by to discuss her new book, Communicating Climate Change, A Guide for Educators. What kind of field experiences inspired Anne to write her book? How can environmental educators facilitate conversations about climate change? What types of resources can educators use to develop programs about climate change? Let's find out. Thank you so much for your time today and stopping by to talk about your book. I've read your book, and it's a wonderful resource.
Oh, thank you.
And it's very practical. It's very digestible, and it really calms my fears and concerns and anxiety about talking about such a huge subject, because it is a huge subject.
Yeah.
I like to begin my conversations with guests to find out about their own relationship with nature. So what is your earliest memory of enjoying nature?
Oh, gosh, that's a hard question. I think my earliest memory of thinking about birds was with my father on the street in where I grew up in Weymouth, Massachusetts, and listening to a mourning dove and my father pointing out the song. And that was like the first bird song that stuck in my head. I think that's one of my earliest memories with nature. And then that kind of followed up with a couple additional bird-related experiences in school. We had leaders from a nature center nearby come and take us on a bird walk in this really scrubby little part of our school schoolyard. And so I learned some additional really common birds. And that along with just being outside and playing hide and go seek, I was really privileged to grow up in a neighborhood that where kids just kind of ran free. And we didn't have so-called wild nature, but we had a lot of nice grassy backyards with oak trees. And so those are, I think, some of my earlier foundational memories. And then my dad really caught on to my love for animals and being outside. And so started taking me on trips with him to New Brunswick and down East Maine. And so then the earlier, I could talk about this for a long time, so I'm sorry. Earlier memory, I just was sitting with my dad on, I'm like actually getting emotional. It's like a really, really special time in my childhood. My dad sitting on these cliffs, watching guillemots dive and sitting there with the thinking, oh, there's nothing here right now, but sitting long enough so that 5 minutes later, a bald eagle is soaring over. And a minute later after that, a seal comes by. And yeah, those were my, excuse me.
Yeah, no, don't worry. No, that is a very special, special time. And what I'm finding with my guest is that their interest in nature, their first experiences with their family, and their really most special experiences, it all began with their family.
And
it's really very much a common thread. When did you realize that nature was important to you?
I don't know if there was a specific moment. I think it was just always, it always was. And so when I started, maybe I became kind of politically aware during the 1992 elections when George Bush was up for re-election. And I watched the debates with my parents. And I know my parents pointed out, maybe because they knew that I really loved being outside, and I loved whales. I was really into whales at that time. I was a whale girl. They told me that George Bush was not a very pro-environmental person, that he was a pro-oil person, probably. They didn't specifically say that. And so I wrote him a letter telling him that he should protect the elephants, because I'd watched a lot of nature shows and like nature documentaries on PBS, spent a lot of Saturday mornings watching those. And I remember my mom saying, but Annie, we don't have elephants in the United States. Why don't you write him about animals that we have in the US? And I was like, no, I'm writing about elephants. I think it doesn't matter. George Bush should protect the elephants. And being really disappointed then when I got like a form letter back that said, you know, thank you for your interest. So that was my first kind of political involvement as a 7-year-old.
Okay, so you talk about the elephants. How do you address, some educators out there make it a point to say what matters here is more important. Forget about the polar bears.
Yeah.
Worry about what's here.
Yeah, I think probably because what I had seen on nature documentaries was not about my backyard. I never watched a nature documentary about starlings or gypsy moths in southeastern Massachusetts that wasn't negative about you know, those are the things that I encountered every day. And so the things that were privileged and talked about most often that needed to be protected were those far off places and not those nearby places. So I think that's where my mind was at that time, probably as a little kid. So I guess a couple different points there that I think there are some misconceptions that what is physically distant is necessarily abstract or abstracted from our care, and what is local is necessarily good and relevant and the thing that we care the most about. So I think people always kind of assume, we leap to this conclusion and this assumption that locally place-based education is the best because it's going to be the most relevant. It connects with all of these schema that we already have. We know it. And so we'll love it and care for our local. And then hopefully that will scale out. But I think, and we talk a little bit about this in the book, and I'm not saying that place-based, I am not critiquing place-based education at all. It is so important to be involved in your local community. And probably the example I gave about the elephants is one reason that we should really focus. We should make sure that people know that their places are special, and that there's nature even in urban environments, like in the South Bronx, where I'm doing some dissertation work right now. But sometimes the theory of change for place-based education, or for really focusing on the local aspect of place-based education, misses the point that we are really impacted by things that seem unique from other places, and that can equally be a motivator and a channel for people to become involved.
How did you begin your career in environmental education? Okay, we know that it started in a very early age for you personally, but professionally, when did you decide to enter this field?
I kind of fell into it. In college, I was an English literature major and a geosciences minor, and I was walking through the halls of the English department the summer in between junior and senior year, thinking about what am I going to do? I didn't really want to go to graduate school for English literature. Although I really loved everything about my English major, it just didn't, career-wise, wasn't exactly where I wanted to go. And I saw this poster for environmental and science journalism, a graduate program. I can't remember where. And I was like, that's what I want to do. I would like to write about the science that I love. I'd like to, you know, this is how I can combine these two things. And it never occurred to me before. But then I didn't get any internships in science or environmental journalism. And I did get internships in environmental interpretation with the National Park Service. And during my third internship, which was with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation at a small nature center in central New York, I just was on the trail one day with a bunch of 7-year-olds, and they were gleefully pointing out squirrel tracks in the snow. And I just thought to myself, why am I trying to do environmental journalism when this is so much fun and so good and I can do this and I know I can do it. I'm just going to stick with this. And so then I went on to get like longer seasonal positions. I got an MPS in environmental interpretation from SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry, and then worked for a while as an education director at the Chincoteague Bayfield Station in Wallops Island, Virginia, before deciding that I wanted to think more in the abstract and come back to school.
Yeah. And from there, you went straight to Cornell?
From Virginia. Yeah, I was on the Eastern Shore of Virginia for 5 years, from 2010 to 2015.
And then what made you move to New York?
I was doing this oyster restoration project in collaboration with this really neat intergenerational nature-based family learning program called Shore People Advancing Readiness for Knowledge, or SPARK, on the Eastern Shore of Virginia. And so it was in collaboration with SPARK and Shippensburg University in Pennsylvania. Shippensburg University was one of the members of our field station, the Chincoteague Bay Field Station. And Dr. Sean Cornell was doing a lot of geomorphology and geoscience and coastal geology work that had involved looking at oysters and oyster spat in Chincoteague Bay. And then fast forward, Hurricane Irene and then Hurricane Sandy, and we lost 12 feet of land at a little satellite property of ours in Greenbackville, Virginia. And so the SPARK program and Dr. Cornell's work and our interest in doing something that could be a model for coastal resilience, all combined with this Toyota Together Green Innovation grant to do some oyster restoration and put in oyster, what they're called, castles. they're like cement Legos that you put in different arrays that attract, or you hope attract, oyster spat to settle on. Anyway, so looking at this, watching this program kind of move forward and the positive feelings that it generated among this diverse group of participants that included older adult master naturalists from our local master naturalist chapter, university students from Shippensburg and other universities, our local SPARK families who were pretty diverse given the shore's demographics. I just started thinking about environmental education as a catalyst for community building around controversial topics like climate change, because this was really a sea level rise adaptation project. We did get people who definitely did not think about sea level rise in terms of climate change at our community meetings. And so that's kind of what made me think more about, then I met Marianne Krasny, although she doesn't remember it, at a North American Association of Environmental Education conference in 2013. And I saw her civic ecology lab sign, and that is what I do. And I just kind of tucked it away. And after going a little bit further with the restoration project, started thinking, okay, I'd like to think more about this in a different way and in a different setting. And so I applied to Cornell.
Okay, so I'd like to turn attention to your book and some questions that I have to help educators talk about climate change in their programs and to their audiences. Climate change education, as you so clearly point out, is about engaging in a conversation with others that are influenced by their experiences and their values and their worldviews. And when you're in a conversation with other people, you have that many worldviews and values and all that feeding into that conversation. And I'll refer to the values and worldviews as the tip of the iceberg in terms of influences, of items that are influencing that conversation. Right. And it made me think of the iceberg model of culture that I have. I put it in the chat here.
I just see that, yeah.
And so I learned about this iceberg model in an intercultural competence class that I took last year, a workshop, about five, six-week workshop. And after the workshop, I interviewed the instructor, and Claudia Diaz Carrasco is my guest in episode 9 of the podcast. And so in addition to experiences and values or worldviews, you can see on the iceberg other things feeding into a conversation, like learning styles and leadership styles and concepts of fairness and all sorts of things, all these moving parts. Mm-hmm. your comments in your book made me think of that and all of these issues. And so my question is, in a conversation where people are not starting in the same place, mm-hmm. and you don't know what the others know, and they don't know what you know, so everyone begins the conversation being right. And assuming the conversation is beginning from a neutral and a considerate and a generous place, what should an educator consider as the facilitator of a conversation? How can they move a conversation forward? And what should they listen for as they navigate a conversation and speak with other people?
So I think probably if you're an educator leading a workshop and then starting, and you said people don't know, and you don't know what other people know, and they don't know what you know. So then starting from there and establishing what people know is probably the first step. And I think I've seen this done in neat ways. I know educators are very creative in getting and doing this interactively. And so this is, and so you can ask people straight out to just tell me what you know about climate change, or what do you think about climate change? And then, but I think what you know about climate change is probably a better question, and have people brainstorm or write. The place that I worked at in Virginia, the Chincoteague Bay Field Station, when I left, was developing a mind mapping activity or concept map activity around climate change, where students who were coming to the program, the first thing that they did was do a concept map of climate change as a group on the whiteboard, to just sort of get out there, okay, what are our perceptions? What do we know that's factual? What are some of the emotions that we bring to this? What are some of the misconceptions that people have? And then that allows you to see what they know without, and let them tell you, so that you don't write off, you know, right from the get-go, maybe make people feel uncomfortable. And then you can, you know, draw on specific things that they've said. And if there are those misperceptions or misconceptions about how climate change works, start digging deeper into those with whatever activities you have planned.
In climate change education, there appears to be two fronts. One is very hard-hitting and focused on emergencies. Mm-hmm. And the other front makes a conscious effort to avoid doom and gloom scenarios. Mm-hmm. To avoid, as you so clearly explained, triggering people's terror management responses. And you, in your book, you suggest educators should build the confidence of the participants in their programs so that they can see themselves as being part of a feasible solution. And you suggest very easy to do activities like biking or using public transportation or walking. And they all make good practical steps, really good, smallest viable steps that people can make. Even so, sometimes in a conversation, you know, there are individuals out there in the world who don't think that this is enough. Mm-hmm. And so how do you respond to individuals who want to engage in conversation about the hard-hitting emergencies and whose mode of communication seems to be always having their voices raised or just always pushing information, dramatic information in your direction?
Right. So maybe I'll tackle the those things aren't enough question part of the question first, because they're not, but they may be entry points to other forms of action. And so I think for example, one of the organizations that we highlight in the book and from which I interviewed people for my master's thesis is the National Network for Ocean and Climate Change Interpretation. And they really focus on community level solutions. So how can you make that biking to work, not just you alone biking to work, but even if it's biking with your colleagues or working with your company to set up a new bike rack to facilitate that process, so that it's a little bit more tackling things on the system level rather than the individual level. And especially, you know, I think, I don't know if I had written this book this year, how things would have changed and how I would have written it a little bit differently. And so we listened to somebody like Greta Thunberg, who talks a lot about the climate crisis and your house is on fire and it is time to panic. And then we look at how she is really the forefront of this massive mobilization inspired by those words of urgency and crisis. But there's something about her and her youth that has, I don't know, inspired people like, I can do it too, or I can participate in this too. Even with that climate crisis framing that Greta Thunberg uses, and that we have the Guardian newspaper from out of the UK, they now write about climate. They have totally gone away from climate change and they write only about the climate crisis. But then it's still important to consider those things that we can do, but that without some sense of how can I mobilize can lead people to a sense of despair, which I think we don't need. And well, I'm going to back up.
Take your time. Yeah. Cause your suggestions are very practical, easy to do. And it's a really good way to build confidence and so that people can feel like they're part of a collective effort.
Right. So then as an educator, I guess it's always our job to remind people that it's wonderful that we're now doing these things and what can we do next? Or how can we build from here? And how can we use our community resources like what we have? And so I teach this massive open online course called Climate Change Science Communication and Action in partnership with Cornell Cooperative Extension and Cornell Institute for Climate Smart Solutions. And so that global group has been really important, I think, in understanding what climate action looks like in different contexts, having a space to kind of grieve about losses that we see and be open about how sad we are about the climate crisis and climate change and what it's doing to communities all around the world, but then also draw inspiration from each other. And so that dealing in education, somehow in education programs, dealing with that mix of space for grieving and yet also space for action is important. And so maybe dealing that person who comes with that loud voice who is, I don't know, sometimes those people are, we need to act now. And sometimes those people are, it's too late. Why are we even here? Mm-hmm. Maybe acknowledging that the emotion that they're feeling is real and that many of us feel that weight on us every day. And then maybe ask them to share what they're doing and how can we participate in that or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Which that's a perfect segue to my next question. Throughout your book, you recommend that educators partner with educators or people outside of the environmental education field and with all sorts of different parties within their communities. Where do you feel the need for collaboration is greatest?
Oh, probably depends on where you are and what the needs are in your particular community. So I've been doing some work in the South Bronx with this organization called Rocking the Boat. And there is like this phenomenal organization. It's a nonprofit where teens come and build handmade, gorgeous wooden rowboats. And then a group of those teens also takes those rowboats out to do water quality monitoring and environmental restoration projects. And so, but one of the major problems in the South Bronx is air quality, because they are, they have one of the largest wholesale fruit markets in the United States. And so they're just diesel trucks coming in and out. It's a very industrial portion of the Bronx. And so they're partnering with public health officials is probably in public health, and then social justice advocates or social and environmental justice organizations. And maybe wherever you go, these are like three critical types to partner with. But yeah, the social and environmental justice organizations and the public health organizations that are working, that are all concerned about kind of the same issues and how they're affecting people's lives and the environment.
I touched upon partnering and building community when my conversation with Dr. Rupu Gupta from New Knowledge Organization.
Yeah.
And that was a two-part episode. We had really good conversation about how to establish relationships and how to, and she shared with us the tool that they use to find out what your collaborators think of, what their perspective about environmental education is. And so that was very interesting and very helpful.
Was that because she was that her the Q sort that they did the, uh-huh. the card that, the
that's
card
right.
sort
yeah.
Cool activity
yeah. This is such a huge topic, and you know your book you laid out your book beautifully. Let me take a moment to review the book for listeners. The first section, well, there's you cover lots of research, the facts of climate change, research about attitudes and knowledge and education outcomes. You also cover the psychology of climate change. You discuss identity and psychological distance and cognitive dissonance theory and all sorts of wonderful things. And then you go into talking about your the case studies. You have case studies that you present on how four different individuals from in four different learning environments teach about climate change. And then you also have, which I found very helpful, is your hypothetical, your fictional educators that you, their stories that you carry throughout the book. How did you come to the format of this book? Because there's a whole bunch of references, citations, literature cited. How did you manage such this a major topic, all the references, and then put all these different stories in there?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of so I was coming, I had just left a nonprofit job, and all of a sudden I found myself as a graduate student in an office where nobody came to bother me, and where I could just sit and read and write all day. And I happened to come in to an appointment under an EPA grant called EE Capacity that Marianne Krasny had. In affiliation with North America, in partnership with North American Association of Environmental Education. And she was at the tail end of this grant cycle and was interested in putting together a series of legacy products. This is kind of the history of the book. And she wanted one of them. They had run a climate change education online course, and they had done this really wonderful climate change community fellowship through the EE Capacity grant program. And so she was looking for some kind of legacy product that would sort of wrap everything up. And I started, so I just started a literature with my own interest in climate change, having been worked on the sea level rise adaptation projects in Virginia, and just jumped right into looking at climate change education, and just found myself kind of overwhelmed, but also really interested in the climate change communication and environmental psychology literature, thinking like, wow, I could have really used this as an educator, and I had no idea that this was out here. And as we were developing the series of legacy products, Marianne suggested to another one of the people who was working on this, Phil Silva, that he do a series of vignettes. And so I was like, oh, I'll incorporate that. That sounds cool. And then we started thinking, but throughout the time I worked really hard throughout the literature review to just kind of tie things together thematically and think about how all of this relates to how we do education. And so how do we tie in, how does communication, the concept of framing, what does that mean in education, and how does that actually relate to this sort of separate identity literature? How can I put this into an educator's framework? And so that's when we kind of got to Martha Munro and Susan Jacobson's really nice program development cycle, kind of tacked that our applied the climate change communication literature to that, and started thinking about how everything fits together. So I think I even have a Prezi presentation where I kind of mapped all of this out starting in October, my first year here. And it just snowballed from that. And maybe the tying the vignettes in throughout the book, I believe that was a reviewer comment when we sent the book out for a review. And that was really helpful.
Yeah, it is the most readable book or a reference that I've come across. Because there's lots of literature out there, of course, as you well know. And some of them, there's yes. good points. It's, oh, that's interesting. Uh-huh. But then you put it down and there was so much in there that it doesn't stick with you. This yep. sticks with you, and this makes you feel brave, okay, and makes you feel confident, and And at least for me, I can only speak for myself. So I know I can always refer back to it and say, okay, I remember this here. So let's refresh my memory. I can do this and go back to it. Yeah,
I'm so glad.
It's very good. It's a wonderful book. How long did this take? Your book was published in November of 2018.
Yeah. So I started the literature review in 2015 and then had a draft of the book by July of 2016. And then I had a baby. And I think we sent the book out for its first review in January 2017. And then the next December 2017, I finished my master's thesis and wrapped up all of the reviewer comments. New Year's Day. Well, I wrapped up all of the reviewers' comments New Year's Day 2018. So it took, and then there are some, few further edits from there. But the writing process was not quite 3 years.
Yeah, that is still, I think it's fast though, considering all of the resources that you went through to tell your story. Yeah.
I think it actually points to the thing that I do well as a graduate student is reading and synthesizing. And the thing that I'm not so fantastic at yet is planning my own research. I'll read other people's.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't put that in there.
Okay. So you've built this wonderful tool for educators. So how can educators develop a program about climate change? What should they consider when developing a program?
So I think in the first, so the first thing that you always want to consider is, okay, who am I actually giving this program to? What do they already know? And what do I want them to know? What are the goals of the program? Am I trying to build literacy? And how am I defining literacy? And then, or are we actually going to mitigate climate change in some way with this project? Or are we building self-efficacy and it happens to be that we're also talking about climate change? So really thinking about what you want to get out of the program and then what people already know and what they might want to get out of it. And then kind of going from there, thinking about what activities would support that. What resources you already have, what activities you already do that might be able to be revamped. And then looking for other resources and new things that would work well. And then, of course, always monitoring and evaluating. Yeah. Okay, what worked, what didn't work?
In my audience, there are independent educators, freelance educators, and they aren't necessarily working at a fixed location. And so the audience changes, the settings changes, the interaction changes. When their interactions are brief, and in these types, in settings that are described as free choice learning settings, where choice and control are with the visitor, how can these independent educators address climate change? And because I think about the interactions can be so brief. And of course, I know it depends on what they're there for in the first place in that setting. How can they touch upon such a big topic, do you think?
So I'm thinking of a free choice learning setting where somebody is an independent educator, like maybe at a festival or they're doing a booth somewhere. Mm-hmm. So the Climate Urban Systems Partnership, which was an NSF funded project in Pittsburgh, New York, Philadelphia, and DC, I think, they developed these really neat festival kits that were really interactive, and the goal was to bring kids to the table with materials that kids knew how to use. So for example, the kids would come and build Lego streets and then put sponges in and look at, and it's really similar to a Project Wet activity actually, and then pour water over and think about, so that the sponges represent green infrastructure or, bioswales or whatever it happens to be. Then what amount of green infrastructure do we need for the runoff to be less? And so then while the kids are kind of exploring and constructing, this adaptation solution, then the educators are sort of engaging with the parents about that. Now, that's not that brief. That's probably, I don't know how brief that is, but that could probably be anywhere from 5 to 1/2 minutes to 1/2 hour, depending on how much the kid likes the activity. But I know the National Network for Ocean and Climate Change Interpretation, since they work a lot with people, or they're the people who they trained were educators and interpreters in zoos and aquariums, who often also have those, you know, I've got 5 minutes to make my message. And so they really focused on that, like a couple sentences of, okay, why is this happening? The sentence, something about what we can do about it. And then here's what you specifically can do about it. And then they developed a series of metaphors that had been tested by the Frameworks Institute to make climate change just really kind of quickly and easily understandable to somebody who didn't know all that much about it. I guess that doesn't get to the political aspect of this, which is you don't know who, if you're in a free choice learning environment, you don't necessarily know what people's, it's harder to anticipate. But at the same time, at least at zoos and aquariums, and from what I heard from the CUSP people, most people who came to their booth kind of self-chose and were open.
Yeah, yeah, no, yeah, exactly. And the CUSP acronym is?
Climate Urban Systems Partnership. They worked with Carnegie Mellon. I think Carnegie Mellon was what, like, the lead academic institution on this NSF grant that funded that project.
Mm-hmm. You wrote this with educators in mind, and I was wondering if you wrote one for parents or for children, what would you change?
Well, I don't know if I'd write a climate change communication book for children. If I wrote something for children, then it would probably be all about like something about why climate change is happening, and then what some people are already working on with youth, especially highlighting youth activists and youth organizations. Like the Alliance for Climate Education, Alliance for Climate Education, but also figures like Greta Thunberg. And then I think, and since there's an article that came out recently that has all of these other youth activists. And this is a good question, because I have to actually do a teen related climate program in a couple weeks. Anyway, so I'd start with the basics, but start with the basics of climate change, get that basic climate literacy going. But then maybe there would be a box call outs or something like that, even in that climate science chapter that highlighted what people were doing to address the issues. So I think I would work hard to tie in, I don't want to call them solutions because we're not really solving climate change, but actions that people are working on. I might use the drawdown resource as a touchstone for talking about climate actions. And then maybe I would have something that like scaled up. So it was like climate actions as an individual, climate actions in my family, climate actions in my community and school. Yeah, I think I would probably, and then also wrap in the stories. It would probably be, this sounds like a book series.
Yeah, it sure does. And then and that would be a good one for parents too, a good family book, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. Since publishing the book, is there anything that you think you would change at this point?
Yeah, I would add a justice and equity piece to the book. And that is one thing that is sorely lacking. And so kind of in response to, especially just over the last year and a half since the IPCC report came out in 2018, that's, you know, said we have 12 years, that report. I have become so much more conscious of my lack of attention to those, to climate justice and equity in climate actions. And so there would definitely be something about that. And I would hope to weave it through the book. that is a huge gap right now. And so I think if I ever were like invited to do another edition, then that would be its own chapter plus a vignette, plus a case study, plus things that we're wrapped in. And so what we've done in our course this last year because the course that we run uses this book as its textbook and along with a lot of other readings, but we've added some climate justice lectures or a climate justice lecture and readings, and then have tried to weave the concepts through.
What's next for you?
So I'm working on my dissertation right now, and I spoke a little bit about it earlier, but you know, one of the reasons that I came to Cornell was to work with Marianne Krasny and really think about environmental stewardship and the processes of environmental restoration and monitoring that bring people together. And so the work that I'm doing in the South Bronx with Rocking the Boat is really like the kind of an exploratory case study that I hope will be the foundation for the rest of my dissertation work. So yeah, if you talk to me in 2021, that's my timeline. We'll hopefully have that completed, and we'll have a few other cases that I'll have looked at in different places, and we'll have fleshed out the Bronx case study as well. And some of the things that I'm just like really interested in are how the places that people are in, like the material nature of those places. So the dirt and the water and the tools that they use for water quality monitoring, how all of those affect the social interactions that they have, and how all of that ties together to build cohesion.
Mm-hmm. You wrote this book for environmental educators, and it really doesn't matter if they're independent or affiliated with an organization, a nature center, museum, or anything. It is a wonderful resource. Thank you so much for your time this morning. I so enjoyed speaking with you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. I really appreciate, and I wanted to, before we sign off, I just wanted to acknowledge my co-authors, Marianne Krasny and Jonathan Schultz, for the work that they put into the book and mentoring me, and to Marianne in particular, and telling her first year grad student that she could write a book, and like giving me the space and the opportunity to do that. Not all advisors would be second author on a grad student's
mm-hmm.
book.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They might be first author.
Yeah.
And she's been so wonderful and she's just wonderful.
Talaterra is a podcast for and about independent educators working in natural resource fields and environmental education. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and colleagues. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Tanya Marion.